Okay, this is Joan Weaver, and I'm at the Kinsley Library. It's December 11th, 2014. We're interviewing Jim Mowry today. I think that's all I need to say. Jim, let's start out with when you were born.
Well, I was born in Roselle, Kansas. March 6, 1930.
And who were your parents?
Mr. and Mrs. M.M. Mowry. They were originally from Lyons and Sterling.
And what was your mother's name, their given names?
Carrie Bell Temple. And my dad was Magnus Melvin Mowry.
Magnus, that's a neat name. What brought the, had they been lived in Kansas all their lives too, or
yes, they were born and raised in Kansas. Mother was a farm girl and dad was a city boy.
Mm-hmm.
He was born in Sterling and mom was born in Geneseo, Kansas.
Mm-hmm. Those are pretty close together. Did you have any brothers or sisters?
I have one sister. Her name was Wanda Jean Mowry, and she died at the age of 25 with cancer.
Oh. Was she older or younger than you?
Older.
Older. So then you and only you are left. Okay, what brought your parents to Ellenwood? No, Roselle. What brought your parents to Roselle?
Dad was working for the railroad. He was the agent at Roselle for a while.
This is the Santa Fe Railroad?
Yes.
So you carried on a tradition that we're going to get to here.
Yes, when you get right down to it, it was a railroad family. My father was a railroader, I was a railroader, and my father-in-law was a railroader.
How about your grandfathers? Either of them?
No, he was a farmer.
He was a farmer, okay. What do you remember about your childhood? You told me a story a little bit ago about when you were born. You want to put that on this?
Well, I was born about 3 months before Main Street of Roselle burned to the ground. And, of course, I was young enough, I don't remember, but my mother told me that her and the high school boys carried all her furniture 3 blocks north to a vacant lot because our house was right at the end of Main Street, and luckily the fire didn't get our house, so from there we moved to Ulysses, and that was prior before they got Main Street rebuilt too. So
maybe before we go on, did your father tell you any interesting railroad stories that go back to his time period?
No, other than he coached me on what to do to get a job, and he was a perfectionist, because to get on a railroad back in them days, you had to almost memorize a 300-page rule book, because you had to write it by heart and answer questions. And he made me memorize it, and that started it all. And it was a good deal because I got a lot of good jobs because I knew what was going on. But as far as his time on the railroad, the railroad was, to him, was what was happening at the present time. He didn't never go back and expound on his problems or anything with the railroad.
Okay, and then your family, you said, moved to?
From Roselle, we moved to Ulysses, Kansas, just in time for the Dirty 30s.
Okay, and that's what we want to talk a little bit about today. What's your memories of the Dust Bowl?
Well, at Ulysses, we weren't really in a Dust Bowl. Dust is when you can see around town and everything. and could breathe in it. Where we lived at the time was the center of the, what they call the Dust Bowl. I call it the Dirt Bowl, because we had dust mostly every day. No trees in town, no nothing like that. Grass didn't grow. Went to school wearing a respirator. And when it would get so dusty in the school, they let school out. And of course, back in them days, there was no such thing as school buses or anything, so there was very few cars, and we'd walk home. Me and my sister would walk home from school together. And it's really, if you don't live through it, it's really hard to describe, because when them storms would come up, like I say, we were used to dust, because there was dust in the air all the time, even in the smallest of breeze. But when the big storms would come up, it would kind of roll in like a, I tried to think the other day how I would describe it, and it's kind of like a typhoon or something like that. They'd roll in, it'd get a little dustier, and the wind would come up a little bit, and then it'd come up really bad, and it'd get real dark. You couldn't see anything in the house. Our houses were all, windows were all taped shut. Only one door would open to the outside. And of course, the dust was so thick and the wind that it still cover up your floors in the house. Mom used to not vacuum. We didn't have vacuum in them days. She had a broom and a scoop shovel, and that's what she cleaned her floors with. And what little grass we had was whatever we watered by from a well in the on the property. And the grass rakes were like an inverted snow shovel. They were in the shape of a C backwards with little teeth on it, and you'd scrape all the dirt off out into the street, and the city would blade it off.
So the grass was growing, but you had to get the dust that had blown on top of it off.
Correct.
I've never heard that story. So you raked the dirt out.
Your rake was like a push snow shovel, you know, only reverse.
Okay.
You pulled it, and it had little teeth on the bottom so it wouldn't tear up the grass. And we planted some trees in front of our house there at Ulysses, and they grew up to about 7 foot tall, and that's as tall as they get, even if by watering them. But to get back to the big storms, the wind only blew on the edges, the front edge of it, and then it would get dead calm. And that's when you really got the dirt. It just flakes of dirt fall on straight down like snowflakes. And it would really stack up. And then as the storm got on by, the wind would pick up again, and eventually it would die out to just the dust blowing in the air again.
So it was sort of like the eye of a hurricane?
Yeah. It was the best way to describe it. That's exactly the way it was. And however, the wind didn't get that strong. 40-mile-an-hour wind was normal. And that's about all it got, but that 40-mile-an-hour with that much dirt falling, it'd stack up on your car and on the ground out there like snow. And it buried fence rows, it buried what few shelter belts were out there. Us kids used to go out after a storm with shovels, and we'd dig tunnels through them shelter belts, and we had tunnels running all over them. There's, I don't know, fence posts on top of fence posts out there, because farmers go out and refence their property ever so often. And we lived right on the west edge of town at the time, last street in town, Ulysses. And the storms always come from the southwest. And we could see them coming long before they got to town. They didn't move very fast. But it was something else. And then we, fortunately, our house had a basement in it. So we eventually shut off the upstairs and lived in the basement because it was clearer down there. And Mom would go up during the day and clean the house and then we'd come down. But it was different. And eventually she got dust pneumonia and we had to move. Dad had a chance for a job in Ellenwood, Kansas, so we moved to Ellenwood from there, and that Ellenwood was the first snow I ever saw.
Okay, let's wait before we go to Ellenwood and first snow. Couple of questions. You said when you went to school you had a respirator. What was that?
Well, you see them on this little white mask.
Okay. It's the white
nose.
Cloth.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then eventually they come out with the regular respirators with filters on,
like
the
a gas
side.
Mask, sort
yeah.
of.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And how else did
I've heard people say they put wet cloths or something over their mouths when they slept, or what it did, or were you in the basement and you didn't need to worry about that?
Well, no, we had. Covers over our bed.
Oh, okay.
A sheet over the building.
Like a canopy bed,
yeah.
That sort of thing.
And, but we slept in the mask during mm-hmm. that worst storm. So day in and day out, you didn't have to. It was just dust in the air like we have around here every mm-hmm. once in a while. And, or like when you driving down the highway and a farmer's plowing a field and the wind's blowing and the dust blows across the highway. It was that way every day, 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. And we were used to that. That's what gave my mother a dust pneumonia, was constantly breathing that air.
What were the symptoms of dust pneumonia?
Well, it was just like flu. When you first got it, and then it had turned to pneumonia, but it was caused by dust.
Well, by flu, you mean coughing?
Coughing and couldn't breathe and high temperature, and your lungs were full of dirt.
Mm-hmm.
And
the treatment was just to get away from it?
Yeah, they could treat you, but then when you went back, and got in it again, you got it quicker. Mm-hmm. And she finally couldn't get over it, and so we had to move. And
now, did these dust storms affect your dad? Maybe you don't know this, but your dad was working railroad. Did the dust storms affect the trains?
Oh yeah, the big storms, everything stopped out there. But the rest of the time, they were all steam engines back then and everything. And they didn't have no problems, but they all had to wear dust masks too and everything. But
did they have to go out and uncover track?
Yeah, section crews had to, that reminds me, all the steam engines had what people nowadays call a snowplow on the front of their cow catchers out there. And they would plow snow or dirt
the
as
dirt.
They went along.
Mm-hmm.
And there was enough trains back in them days that it pretty well kept the dirt off the rails.
Mm-hmm.
Not like nowadays where trains are only once in a while, but they were a lot of them back then. Of course, they weren't that big an engine, they couldn't pull that many cars, so when you had a lot of cars, it took maybe two or three trains to pull the number of cars, you know. But no, Dad worked, and I used to go down there. He'd try to write on a desk, and we'd have to first brush the dirt off to write on it, and the paper. But it was a way of life. And
how did it affect your life as a child, other than getting to miss school?
Well, it didn't seem to bother me. I grew up in it, so and I don't remember of even having a sick day. But they were pretty strict on wearing masks and everything. The worst part of it was if you had to go to the bathroom at night in a dust storm, we had a cable that run from the house to the outhouse. Mm-hmm. You didn't dare let go of that or you'd get lost. So, 'cause it literally got so black and so dark that you couldn't see your hand in front of your face.
It's hard. It's hard for me to imagine that.
Right. That's what I say. It's hard to explain, too, because if you don't live through it, I don't know just how you'd explain it. That's why I was trying to think, how would I explain these big storms? And I thought, well, maybe that would be the best way to explain it. But it was just...
Were you ever scared or?
No, not that I remember.
Okay.
I know my mother used to get scared. The grandstand, we had one storm come in, and the grandstand where they raised horses out there, you list at that time, was a quarter of a mile from behind our house. And, I didn't know Mom could yell so loud, but we was having a church party out there, and one of them storm stars, she seen one coming, and she stood at the fence at the back of our house and yelled at me and my sister, and we heard her.
Mm-hmm.
And we run that quarter of a mile to the house and just got in the basement when it hit. And so Mom was, I didn't know she could scream that loud, but she did.
Well, that was sort of a close call. Can you remember any other close calls that your family had? Were you ever out in the car? Or?
No. Back then, we didn't really travel in a car very much. Dad took it to work and come home, and that's the biggest trips other than the trips and like Christmas when we'd go to Grandma and Grandpa's at Geneseo. And I remember coming through Kinsley then when the highway was down 8th Street.
Mm-hmm.
And going on to, but other than any close calls, we were just used to them. I mean,
because your whole early childhood was dust storms. You didn't know anything else.
Yeah, from the first thing I remember is the so-called dust storm, you know, to remember.
Mm-hmm.
And going to school in them, and it was just a way of life. I know winters out there during that time weren't winters like we know now. It got cold and it would freeze water, but that's about as cold as it would get. And we never had any snow.
Really?
No, and what few rains we had, if we got them nowadays, people would think they were not rains, they're mud balls, because it would fall and they could gather that dust up, and when it hits you, it'd get the mud splash.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. I guess you'd have to say that's as close to the old frontier days as I ever lived in. But I didn't see snow until I got to Ellenwood.
And how old were you when you moved to Ellenwood?
I was in third grade.
Mm-hmm.
And
now, did Ellenwood have any effects of the dust bowl?
No, you get, actually, I hate to say this because there'll be people that argue with me, but God said he didn't know what the dust bowl was. But they had dust, but just dust in the air.
Mm-hmm.
Not like we had out there, Ulysses. I mean, it come off of the front part of the Rocky Mountains, that wind somehow or another. Of course, KU and K-State claimed it was account of the way the farmers farmed out there, but they didn't farm any different than anybody else. It was just dry, mm-hmm. period.
Mm-hmm.
And you could go out and scoop dirt with your hands. And no shovel needed to dig a hole, you know, if you wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. But I know when we eventually moved to Dodge, people talk about the terrible dust bowl days, and we just kind of laugh at them and listen to their stories. Dig out pictures and show them what one really looked like. And
well, I think they had a few, but they maybe weren't so continuous as yours. It was
no,
it was,
they didn't have anything close to it. I mean, they had dust storms,
mm-hmm.
actually dust, but not dirt storms. We had pure dirt where the land just rose up and flopped over, and it was dirt. But that's my theory. I mean, there's probably scientists that can tell me different, but I lived through it. I know what it was like.
Well, now, when you moved to Ellenwood, did your mother recover? And
Yeah, she lived to be 92 years old. But we had no humidity out there.
Mm-hmm.
There was absolutely no humidity all that time, and we got to Ellenwood, and there's humidity and cool breezes, but the temperature out there during the Dust Bowl days hardly varied more than 10 degrees. And like I say, once in a while in the wintertime, it would get cold enough to freeze ice, but it wouldn't last.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the ice was dirty. Brown eyes,
yeah.
If you've seen it, those brown eyes. So, but Ellen was the first place I seen snow, and I went nuts because I thought it was dirt. I remember that, and I ran out and jumped on it and went up to my knees in snow, and I couldn't figure out why it was wet and what was going on. And Mom had to tell me because she was from east of there.
What do I want to do? No, not that. Pause. That was okay, I guess. We're recording. Okay, we're talking about the snow in Ellenwood, and what else do you remember about your youth then?
At Ellenwood?
Hmm?
Well, it was changed, and I had a ball there. We had a flood there after we moved there. I'd never seen anything like that, because the closest river out of Ulysses was the Cimarron River, about 10-15 miles south, and it was all sand. It wasn't, only had water in it when it rained up in the mountains. And we had a flood, and our house was built up off the ground about 4 feet, and it got high enough that I could use the front porch as a boat dock, so I got one of Mom's wash tubs and floated it out there and jumped in and floated around all day and got a three-degree burn. I had to go to the hospital for 2 weeks. And just things like that that I hadn't saw, I couldn't understand them, you know. Mom had explained to me I wasn't that being in the third grade, I knew everything, but I didn't know nothing, you know. And I remember rains. I couldn't get enough rains. I was out in the rain day and night. If it, Mama would get up at night and I wouldn't be in bed and it'd be raining, and she'd go out and I was out playing in the rain because didn't have to wear a mask, didn't have, and it was cool. But it was just the opposite of what I grew up in.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to describe that feeling. I can remember, but to put it in words is a little tough. To people just don't understand it, never had to go through it. And to make it clear enough for them to understand that, I hope I never see it again, I'll tell you that. But
well, we just got past December 7th here. Do you remember D-Day?
Yeah.
What were you doing on D-Day? Or not, I'm sorry, the bombing of Pearl Harbor, not D-Day. Let's start with the bombing of Pearl Harbor.
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
Yeah, most of it I remember from listening to the radio and hearing people talk about, adults talk about it, but I was old enough then that I absorbed what was going on. And then, of course, the movie houses had newsreels,
mm-hmm.
and I always went to the movies on the weekends, and of course, a movie only cost a dime back then, and we'd see it all on there, and yeah, I remember. And basically, though, I would say that it was just another adventure to me. I wasn't old enough to really, looking back, I really didn't understand the significance of it.
I guess I should have asked back before that question, because you were living, the Dust Bowl was the Depression, but your father always had a job.
Yeah.
So you think your family didn't feel the Depression as much, or how did the Depression affect you?
Well, we didn't have no money to spend or anything. His wages just went for basics, you know, food, and that's why we didn't drive any place. But then he still managed to take us on vacation in the latter part when the storm started tapering off. We visited other places. There was a kind of a park out in eastern Colorado, just west of Ulysses, about 40 miles. They called Two Buttes. It was two little humps of ground, and it was nice. And then we went out next to them was a petrified forest, and we went to that.
Now, you went in the car. You didn't use the train, because did your family would have some free train passes or something?
Right, we could go any place on the train. And when we moved by train. They bought a boxcar, and we'd load furniture.
Oh.
And,
mm-hmm.
And then take the boxcar to the town we moved to. And yeah, we rode trains all our life. In fact, when me and my wife got married, that's the way we went. why buy gas, you know, or wear out a car? You just go down and get on a train, show your pass, and go.
Okay, well, then back to the other. So World War II probably, you said, was sort of an adventure. It didn't affect you much either, did you?
No, man.
Didn't have relatives that served, or your father would have been too old?
Oh, yeah, my father-in-law. Well, of course, my father-in-law to be, but we didn't. My relatives were all older,
mm-hmm.
and I don't remember any of them that actually was in the service.
Mm-hmm.
But I know me and my sister used to, that night before we'd go to bed, we'd listen to the war news on the radio, and about the only way I was involved with it was the town we wherever we was living, they'd have air raid drills, and you'd have to turn out all the lights and go to a basement or someplace until the all clear sounded, you know, and that's the most I had.
So how long were you in Ellenwood?
Well, it was from the third grade to, we moved to Great Bend in, when I was in seventh grade. And we lived there a year. Nothing exceptional happened there other than I went through the seventh grade. Then we moved to Dodge City. Dad got a promotion and we moved to Dodge.
What was his job in Dodge?
He was a chief dispatcher.
What does that entail?
It entailed making sure no trains run into each other.
Was he there at the Santa Fe Depot there in Dodge? It's still
Yeah, and his office was in the east end of it, and the dispatcher dispatched the trains, and the railroad back then operated on what they called train orders, and each train had a set of orders that would tell them where they were going to meet a train and whether to take siding or stay on the main line and stuff like that. And that was his responsibility to see that the dispatchers done the right thing. He was in charge of all the dispatchers.
Now, is there somebody over him?
Yeah, two people.
Who are, what would they be called?
The train master and the superintendent.
Okay, and then the chief
dispatcher. He was the third in line. Uh-huh. So, and then I graduated from high school there at Dodge, and I'd been working for the railroad on third shift from midnight to 8 in the morning. I get off at the roundhouse there at Dodge City.
This is before you graduated or right after?
Before.
Before.
My junior and senior year in high school, I went to work there at the roundhouse at Dodge where we serviced steam engines. And
so what were your hours there?
8 in the evening till 4 in the morning.
And then you got up and went to school?
Yeah, and I get out of school, I do my homework, and then go to work.
And, didn't get much sleep.
No, but I didn't seem to miss it. I mean, I could sleep. When I shut my eyes, I was asleep, you know, and didn't wake up till the alarm went off.
And so you were working in the roundhouse repairing as like a mechanic?
Repairing, my job at the roundhouse was as a hosser helper.
Hosser. How do you spell hosser? You know? Okay.
H-O-S-I-L-E-R or
something like that. Okay.
That was what they called it in the Santa Fe. And what was it? You helped the engineer. You wasn't a fireman or an engineer. You was a helper. And
so what were your duties then, helping?
Well, I would, when it come to the house, when they come in the yard, I'd go out the end of the house track and run the engine down to the ash pit, kill the fire.
How did you kill the fire?
Well, you'd shut everything off.
Shut the oxygen out to it?
Yeah. And when it died out, then you'd dump the ashes in the ash pit.
Did they go down like a trap door of the train?
Yeah, under the engine, under the firebox, and the engine would open up and dump the ashes. And then before the boiler cooled down, you could still run the engine without a fire for a while. And then I'd run it up on a turntable and get off and turn it to the stall track it was supposed to go in and run it in a roundhouse for mechanics and everything to work it over and get it ready to go back out. And then I go out and pick up another engine and start all over.
How often were engines treated this way? Every time, every engine
every
that came?
Every time one came. Mm-hmm. It was back in them days, them steam engines, their maximum travel time without service was about 200 miles. So wow. That's why there was a division point about every 200 miles. Kinsley was originally designated to be the division point. And the city of Pollard wouldn't let it happen because they didn't want the railroad crash in town. So Dodge City grew up as a division point in Newton, Kansas. And
so the main servicing, you had to get rid of the ashes so you could start over. And then what else had to be done every 2 hours?
Well, then when they got... When the mechanics got done with their inspection and their greasing of all the bearings and all that stuff and got everything working, you had to go get it out of the house, take it out the coal chute, fill it full of coal.
And that coal came from, dumped down from the top,
right? And then go to the water tower and fill it full of water and fill the injectors on the... My job was to fill injectors on a diesel engine, on a steam engine, and then park it in line to go out whenever it was due to go out so it would be first out on the leads.
So what was the turnaround time about?
24 hours.
24 hours, okay.
Yeah. The only engines that come in and went right back out were the through trains. If they was having a problem on the engine, they'd cut it off of the train and bring it down to the roundhouse, and we'd fix it and put it, take it back out, and then it'd go on.
So if you were starting a trip back from back east out, you might change engines.
Oh yeah, they could change engines. They were division point, uh-huh. Actually. Excuse me.
Well, I never realized that. I just assumed you got an engine and you went all the way to California with
well,
it.
Well, a lot of them did, because then the engines on them through trains were big engines. They held a lot of coal, they held a lot of water, and they could go farther than your average little train that run between local towns, you know. But then they got rid of the coal-fired engines and went to oil-fired engines, and then they could go even farther. But it's amazing. I mean, I went through all that. In fact, when I come to Kinsley after working at the roundhouse, we were still running oil-fired engines, steam engines then. And the house track across in front of the depot, if they had an engine that was giving them trouble, they'd always cut it off and park it in front of the depot. And while I was working, I'd go out and maintain it.
Mm-hmm.
So
you were doing this while you were junior and senior in high school.
High school.
And then you graduated, and then what did you start?
Well,
Talk about that memorizing the book that you, or whatever.
Yeah, well, I remember vividly, because why I was working was to save up money to go to Cal Aero Tech in California, because the airlines were just coming into business, and I wanted to get into basics on that. And my father, the year I graduated, summer after I graduated, he said, told me, and I remember him saying, "Son, the railroad has a good retirement, and before you go to California, why don't you try and find a job on Santa Fe and see if you like it." And I thought, well, that's logical, you know, rather than transfer from one area of the United States to another. I could stay at home. And I told him, okay. He said, if you don't like it, then your tuition's already paid. Mm-hmm. You can go next semester or so. And so I got on. It's kind of a neat job.
Now, you were saying, I think, before we started the tape about in order to get on, what the procedure was to get hired on the railroad, yeah. Memorizing that book. And
yeah, I think I got a rule book. You wouldn't believe it. They called it a rule book, but I called it a book to fire you by. Because if you violated them rules, you got demerits. And if you got 100 demerits in your lifetime, you were automatically fired. But it was rules that you had to operate by on a railroad. And
so is this what you went did then to try to get a job, or does you had
yeah,
to know that?
Yeah, you
book?
Had to go. You had.
But you didn't need to know that while you were working as a junior and a senior, while you were in high school.
No, at the roundhouse.
Okay.
No.
This is,
it was just a job. They hired the people just off the street, and well, you had to qualify for the job, but
yeah.
You just had to show them you could do it to qualify. But to work the job I had, you had to take a 6 months apprenticeship first, and during that apprenticeship, you had to learn to telegraph. You had to learn the rules. And then when the agent that you was working for at the time said you was ready to qualify, they'd take you to the division office and give you a test, see if you really knew it. If you didn't really know it, you didn't get a job. But as it turned out, my dad made me memorize that book. I used to be able to quote the page and the real number and everything in the book. And of course, Dad was also a rules examiner, so that was his pet peeve, you know, somebody didn't know the rules. And it worked out, but anyway, come time I got in. A railroad operates on seniority. The more years you get in it, the more safer your job is, you know. And I got a cut. I'd worked that summer. And then I decided, well, I wouldn't go to Cal Aerotech. It was a pretty nice job. Hardest thing I had to do working in the office was keep a potbelly stove lit during the wintertime, you know. I learned how to bank a fire and all that stuff. And
what were you doing in the office?
Well, I was learning to be an agent.
An agent.
Yeah.
And an agent is the one that sells?
No, he runs the railroad in each town. He's the boss of the railroad in each town.
But he's under the dispatch chief, he's down the road.
Yeah, he's the fourth man down.
Fourth man, okay.
And from the top. But I don't know where to go from there, because I just started working. I got half of my money back from Cal Aerotech, and I stayed on the railroad, and then I started going with this gal, Dodge.
How'd you meet her? School?
Well, she was 2 years younger than me in school. And I met her, I was a pickup.
Oh, you were the pickup.
Yeah. I'd went to a movie on a day off, and it was about, the movie let out about 11:30 at night, and my boyfriend, the kid I run around with, was going with her.
Oh.
And they drove by. I was walking home. I had about a mile and a half to walk home. And they drove out and hollered and asked if I wanted to ride. And well, sure, I wanted to ride rather than walk a mile and a half, you know. And I got in the car, and the first thing they asked was, you got any money. Well, they knew I did because I was working, you know. They were low on gas, so I bought them $1 worth of gas. Gas was 19 cents a gallon at that time. And we rode around all night. That's when I met her. And then, of course, I seen her in between times when we were together. Mm-hmm. And then one day, I don't know what the conversation was, but he was talking about her, and somehow it come up, and I told him, I said, "Well, I'll bet you a case of beer I can take her away from you." And he said, "Well, I'll bet you can't." I said, "Okay." And I always told my wife, I said, "That was the only bet I should have lost." But I won that bet.
And her name was Beryl.
Beryl.
Beryl. Beryl. B-E-R-Y-L. Beryl. Okay, and yeah. That, you got married in 1949.
Yeah. And here...
Now, were you an agent at that time, or were you still working towards
it? I was still good, working for it when I moved here. And, we got married. I was on what they call the extra board at that time. When we got married, I was in different towns relieving agents for vacation.
Okay, and that was extra board? Is that what
it's called? Extra board.
Okay.
Whenever you go around and relieve other people at different towns. And so, yeah, we got married on a Sunday.
Where did you get married? In
Kinsley Courthouse.
On a Sunday?
Yeah. And, I had to go to work that night, so I took her to my mother and dad's house, and I went to work, and I didn't see her till Thursday when my day off was.
So, not much of a honeymoon.
No. No, there wasn't. We took our honeymoon probably a couple of years after we got married, my first vacation, because when you first start a railroad, you don't get vacations. You have to earn them, you know. Which I eventually was getting 2 months vacation a year before I retired. Then we moved here to Kinsley.
So you were assigned to Kinsley at that time, or you were still?
No, I was still relieving, but Kinsley was kind of a central place. So I moved here, and I was still relieving agents when I got my job here at Kinsley. And then I was here for...
And what were you hired here as?
As an operator.
An operator.
Train order operator. But I eventually got up to agent. Uh-huh. And raised my three kids here. Yeah. We just come to Kinsley to see where we wanted to go, because like I say, the railroad operated on seniority. When a vacancy came up, the guy with the oldest seniority that bid on a job got it. Mm-hmm. And so we thought, we like Kinsley, so we just stay in Kinsley until we find out where we want to go. And I'm still here.
I'm
still looking.
Now, is that unusual? Your dad moved quite a bit, but
yeah.
But
no,
you didn't.
That's really unusual. Of course, I didn't stay here all my career. I lived here all my career.
Okay.
And after cars and roads got improved and popular, I was here about 13 years. And then I went to Spearville for 13 years as the agent there. And then I come back to Kinsley. And then I went to Dodge. I started my railroad career in Dodge City, and I ended it in Dodge City. Mm-hmm. And I ended it when the B&M and the Santa Fe merged.
So you worked for the Santa Fe all the time?
Yeah, just the Santa Fe. Mm-hmm. And this was a busy town when I was working here. We had a train through town on average 1 hour. And on the days that they weren't running on time, on my shift alone, it was a 24-hour station. I've got records at home that show we had a train through town every 20 minutes.
And were at this time, was it a roundhouse? I know there had been a roundhouse.
Yeah. No, that was all gone.
Yeah.
That was all gone at that time. When I first come here, it was gone, the roundhouse. But the coal chute was still there, and the ice plant was still there, and the pit for the turntable was still down there where it had been. But it went out about the same time the Aunt Nancy disappeared, just before the war.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember the Aunt Nancy. I remember being old, coming over with Dad and looking the yards over, because he was responsible for what took over, where they set things out and all that, you know. I used to travel with him, and even after I started working for the railroad, a lot of our, when we got a day off, we'd spend on a railroad, because we'd go someplace we didn't know how it was laid out, just to see how it was laid out. But Kinsley was probably the most important station on this division, the middle division. We had a 27-level interlocking system here where the operators had to be qualified to operate them. And it was a pretty permanent job once you got it, because we threw all the switches and the signals for the trains that went through here. And two districts wound up here. The 5th District through the Great Bend, and the 2nd District through St. John. The 2nd District was really the main line, because it was the shortest trip to California to come 2nd District. And it was a high-speed railroad where Great Bend was kind of what they call nowadays a branch railroad, but back in them days it was a pretty good railroad. And when you had to funnel 24 trains in 24 hours through the little town of Kinsley, you got to kind of know what you're doing. Because you're responsible. You're throwing the switches for them and keeping the safe so they don't run together and all that. And it was a pretty important station. And like I say, you had to be qualified to do it, and that's what kept me here so long. Otherwise, if I'd have just been out at a little local station, I might have had hundreds of jobs before I retired. But
okay, and then you were an agent, and then did you move up from there, or?
No, that's as high as I got, because I refused a promotion.
Oh.
Because most promotions, you was never home. Mm. And I didn't want to leave my home life. Me and my wife got along so good that I just didn't want to go off and leave her. I refused 3 promotions. I could have made a lot more money, but I was making enough. And I had a home life, loved my wife, and didn't want to go off and leave her. And of course, now if I'd have took the job, I'd have had a bigger pension, but I don't.
Don't need it?
I don't need it, and I don't feel like I made a mistake. I not only have a chance for better jobs on a railroad, I had a chance to go to work for AT&T. I had a chance to go to work for Standard Oil, and in Argentina.
Oh, goodness.
That paid big money and furnished a home, and they had a pretty good deal. They would have took the whole family, and they had a compound that had the schools and everything. Mm-hmm. And they paid me $100 a month to live on, and the rest of the money went in a bank in California. So when I, but it's kind of like service, you had to sign up for 3 years. Mm-hmm. And hit.
Didn't feel like doing that.
We talked about it, and then it was at a time when on the radio they kept talking about uprisings down there, and it was kind of a time of unrest down in Argentina. And I told my wife, we ain't going. I'm satisfied where I'm at. I don't want to put the kids through that. Then AT&T, I went to electronic school in Louisville, Kentucky. Took leave of absence from the railroad. Graduated out of there and took an exam for NASA. And they called me and wanted me to go to Florida when they were building Cape Canaveral. And I didn't want to move there neither. So I turned that down, and AT&T had a big office over here at Dodge. And their manager come over and wanted me to go to an interview at Kansas City. I went down there, and they wanted to hire me, and it would have paid. It started out paying a little less than what I was making on the railroad. But at the end of the first year, had been more, but I had to go to New York to school for a year.
Yeah.
Now, I didn't want to do that, so I should come back to Kennedy. So, I mean, it wasn't a chance I couldn't have made big money. I made big money as far as that goes, more than average store man on Main Street, you know.
Yeah, it was a good, reliable job.
Yeah, and I had that was another thing I didn't want to do. I didn't want to lose my seniority, because when all this was taking place, I was about in the middle of the seniority roster, so I had a lot of places I could go if I wanted to go, and I had a little job protection. It all worked out to the best when I wasn't too thrilled that Santa Fe was merging with the B&M. But I would have stayed with them, except they called me and said, well, they were giving a buyout if I wanted early out. And I said, well, what are you giving? Said, well, you're 2.5 years from old enough to retire. We'll just give you 2.5 years' pay. I said, where's the money? And a guy laughed and talked to him and said, you just made me $20. And I said, well, how did I do that? He said, well, I made a bet $20 you'd take the money instead of working. I said, you're right, so send me half of that, too.
And what year did you retire?
92.
92.
Yeah, after 41 years.
41 years. Okay. I'm going to go back, and we've done a lot of interviews, and several of them with Hispanics, about what one euphemistically called the Santa Fe Hilton. And that was where the crews lived, Hispanic crews and that. Do you have any memories of those in Dodge or here? Or
well, the ones here was out here in Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
Was
it still here when you started?
Yeah, it was still here. It wasn't being used when I came to Kinsley, but it was still here. And Dodge City, when I was working there was a whole community of Hispanics they all lived together out just, and it was just behind the roundhouse at Dodge. Mm-hmm. And of course also at that time Oakley and Satana and places like that had an agent's house too.
Yeah.
The Santa Fe furnished a house.
But you didn't have an agent's out here, did you?
No.
You had your own
home? No. We had our own home, and there wasn't an agent's house here. They had kind of got rid of that before I got enough seniority but I did. When I was out of Montezuma, I did live in the agent's house out there. It was a nice 6-room house. Were the
crews that worked, were they mainly Hispanic in this area, or were they mixed? Or
well, it worked this way. The extra gangs that traveled around and did specific work with the Santa Fe hired the Navajo tribe. They were all Navajos, but they lived in what's called bunk cars.
Mm-hmm.
They were brought in on a train and parked on a siding, and they lived in a bunk car. And each Navajo gang had a chief, and he was the only one that could speak English. So the foreman of that gang, which was a white guy, would tell the chief, and the chief would tell the men. And that chief was like a dictator. Them guys didn't dare not do or say anything, you know. And then the local maintenance guys was basically Hispanic, the section crews and stuff like that. And a lot of them couldn't speak English, but most of them could. But I was around them enough, I could understand it. I never could speak it, but I could understand enough to know what they was talking about, you know. But basically, and then it just matriculated into finally there were some white guys got on the section, and as the other deals faded away, but we had some good section crews. I mean, and them guys would always help you if you needed help. Well, them Navajo Indians were good guys. They were the ones that could understand a little English, but of course they weren't allowed to run around town, honey. They had to stay in the bunk cars. But some of them that knew a little English would come, when I was here, would come down to depot, and I'd talk to them, and if I needed help on something, they'd help me do it, you know.
Well, that's interesting. I'd never realized that there were Indian section crews.
They were extra gangs.
Extra
they were
ones.
Just gangs like Railway. That movie you got, I made them lay in that quarter mm-hmm. mile steel. That's all Navajo Indian.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Is it? Now, you recently watched that. Can you explain to me what, you know, or should we watch it and maybe explain what's happening?
Well, basically, I can explain it. Basically, it starts out where they're unloading a quarter mile steel.
And this is a track that is a quarter mile long?
A section of track. The average section of track back in them days was 33 feet.
And we're talking 19?
Now we're talking a quarter of a mile.
Yeah, but now what year are we talking when you said?
1960.
60, okay. And now they've got this quarter mile, which is,
yeah.
That's a long piece of...
It's a long piece of steel. And... then it shows them preparing the track after they laid the quarter mile steel along the side of the short pieces. And then, as I remember, the film shows Let's see, where did it go from there? It's been so many years ago.
Well, we could stop this and watch it for a second, if you want.
Well, I could probably answer your questions better, tell you what each machine's doing.
Okay, let's stop. Let's pause, if I can get this over there. Okay, we got that rolling, and I'm going to start the film.
Okay, this is unloading the quarter-mile steel, pulling it off the flat cars. They've got a quarter of a mile of flat car there. Each car carries a certain, they set on a pedestal on there that'll swivel so they can go around curves. And that's a picture of the train with the steel on it. That's how long them sections are. And this is called a burrow crane. And it's one that can pick up the steel and travel on a track, and they lay that new rail just alongside the track you see there. And they use that burrow crane to position it and pick it up and put it on after they get the old rail out. And that's generally run by the section crew. Here they're taking the dolly off of the track that they use to pull that rail off in flat cars with. And that's the section crew coming home from a day's work. That was their motor cars back in them days. Now this is where we're actually laying, getting ready to lay. That's the bull crane swinging the rail over next to the rail it's going to replace. You wouldn't think of steel as bending like that, but he just drives down the track that's in place and flips it over. That's out by the old turntable, coming around the curve on the second district. And you can see it looks like a piece of pretzel for steel. That's a 135-pound rail, which was the biggest rail made at the time. I don't know if they make any bigger or not. Here they're pulling the spikes off the side, off of half of the track. They lay one rail at a time. And they're pulling the spikes and the anchors that anchor the rail to the ties. That's the anchor puller there.
So they're taking off the old tractor.
Yeah, there's the old tractor, throwing a section of it off. That cleans the ballast out between the ties, because in places they have to put new ties in. And here, that's called an edge. And I don't know how to spell that, but it goes along after the ties are in and cuts a groove for the tie plates. This is putting asphalt on the ties there because they shaved them all. There they're lining up the tie plates so they're all in a line on the end of the ties to get ready to accept a quarter mile of steel. This is a machine that drags the steel down to the end of the last piece they laid at the joint. Of course, that's a track saw. Takes about 30 minutes to cut through that 135-pound rail. That's so that it cuts it so it's completely square. Now here they've got the track laid and they're going along and putting in the spikes. And then there's spike drivers. They're not the old hammers that you used to see, you guys. So hydraulic spike driver. This is the rail clamps. They're like open C clamps, and they go down beside the ties and clamp around the rail. Those cars there are the bunk cars for the Indians.
And these were Navajo Indians?
Yeah, they're Navajo Indians.
Now, are we looking at Navajos now, or is this?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and they're Navajo Indians. Every once in a while, the spikers would miss a place, and a guy would walk along and put a spike down. They'd have to hand drive, man. This is getting up close to the end of the job. There's one of our power switches that was on our air locker. We're going to throw it by hand. That's the end of the job. There at 8th Street's where the first links ended. And that's the first train bought after they finished the job.
What kind of a train is that?
It's a freight train, and it come through Gray Bend and Larned. Because this other track was the one from St. John, and it wasn't ready to roll on.
Okay, now, and where they were laying it was right here in town.
Yeah, right through town.
Right through town. Those are neat pictures.
That was a... The reason it come about was a quarter mile steel. There was, the railroads was trying to, all over the country, was trying to eliminate so many broken rails. And then 33 foot pieces with a joint over 33 foot were more subject to breakage than a quarter of a mile. So Ben Kinsley to Dodge was the highest speed railroad in the United States. It was a 120 mile an hour railroad for passenger trains. They decided they would test it here at Kinsley to see how it stood up to the weather, because steel expands and retracts considerably in weather. On a hot summer day, it'll expand. And on a cold winter day, it'll retract. And the theory was that the quarter mile wouldn't expand and retract near as much because there was more steel to get cold or hot. So they decided they'd bring that in, and they were put, had just built that new river bridge. And they went over that and into town as a test trip, see how it held up. We got an S-curve through town, which puts a lot of pressure on the rails when a train goes through. And that's why they put it in, and it worked out great. We didn't have no more sun kinks, because then on that 33-foot rail, it'd kink in a hot day because it would get its...
Expand
out and push on the next set of rails and the next set, and then somewhere the pressure would get too much and it'd kink. And we'd have to change a rail, or if we didn't catch it, we'd have a derailment, you know. But anyway, it worked out, and now it's all quarter mile steel to Dodge, you know, all over. In fact, there's an empty rail train sitting on the siding out here in Kinsley right now, where they put some quarter mile steel someplace and stored the cars here. They're empty. Mm-hmm. So there's a steel gang someplace around there. But that was the whole purpose for it, and that plus the fact when the ice house burned down, it was still 33-foot rail down there, and it was such a hot fire that it just turned them rails into pretzels. They got red hot. Once we got rid of the ice plant then, and then this followed up. This is an afterthought, you know, to run through there. But it worked out great. You can still have broken rails and quarter mile steel, and you can still have sun kinks, but they're not as severe. And you go out where the track's all like that, and you can cut the bent piece out and put in a short piece of track. And there is places where they've had to do that. But all in all, the quarter-mile steel is the only way to go. Mm-hmm. It stays put. And it doesn't expand and retract as much as the short pieces. You'd think it would more because of the amount of steel in it, but it seems to dissipate the heat and absorb the cold better.
And Kinsley was the first area they tried that, and they hadn't tried it back east or anywhere else?
Well, they could on other railroads, but I'm talking about
Santa Fe.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think...
And we do have the extremes in weather. So.
Yeah, and I think they had tried it on UP out through the mountains passes. About the same time that Santa Fe tried.
UP, you're talking?
Union Pacific.
Union Pacific, okay.
But I think all the railroads were experimenting mm-hmm. at the same time, but for Santa Fe, Kinsley was an experimental point. And they used that stretch for 5 or 10 years before they ever went on and never had a bit of problem with it.
Well, on this film, we also have had another, I don't know if we need to watch that or not. You want to talk about the train wreck and how that happened?
Train wreck in 1960 was caused by a broken rail. Mm-hmm. We had a local freight train parked in a siding. And, of course, the west yard tracks were full. We had a gang here. It was a bridge and building gang that was checking all the bridges. And they were parked on two tracks in the west yard. And one track was full of just commercial cars, box cars. And we had a Red Ball freight coming out of the west, so we parked the local freight that was switching at every little town in a siding, and the Red Ball freight train was going to pass them here and get out of the road. About 300 feet short of the old viaduct, the rail broke and throw the train into the other train, and the cars started piling up. And
so the train that was moving was thrown into the train
yeah.
on the siding.
Yeah.
And by old viaduct, you mean by the overpass there?
Yeah. The old viaduct, the overpass.
The old one.
If it had been 300 feet farther east, it would have tore that out too, because the car spread. There's a heck of kinetic energy whenever something tries to stop it that weighs 100 tons. Mm-hmm. And true, the train was only doing 30 miles an hour, but the car spread out, and the extra gang cars was over on two tracks away from them. It's kind of funny afterwards. It was scary right at first, but it turned the foreman's bunk car over just as he was getting out of bed. And he said that was a hell of an alarm clock. But he didn't get any hurt. He got a bruise or two, but that's all.
So now what caused the broken track?
It's hard to say. July, I would say, probably it was a sun kink that got too big and popped. Or it could have been, I don't remember exactly what, it could have been at a rail joint too. Because that's just little pieces slapped on there and bolted on between the ends to hold them in line.
So nobody was blamed for...
No, there was no blame for it. It just, one of the things that happened.
And what time of day did it happen?
It happened about 6:30 in the morning, because the foreman was just getting up to go to work when I throwed him out of bed. But the only track we had through Kinsley then with the two trains damaged and everything was the old stock track. And they had to first come in with the steam derricks, then two derricks in there, one's out of Dodge and one's out of Newton. They had to first come in and re-rail them bunk cars and get them out of the road so we could get into the stock track.
Now by re-rail, you mean set them upright and get them back on the...
Set them up and pick them up and
put
set them back on the rail.
So they're still functioning, they just tipped over.
Right. And so then we had the stock track, and that passenger train goes by. That's the old El Capitan, the pride of the railroad. And that probably the slowest it ever run at about 3 miles an hour, because that stock track was only 90-pound rail. And it was used to running on a minimum of 110-pound rail. And that's probably the slowest it ever went through Kinsley. But then people got quite a sight, because it was right in the middle of that train wreck. But then at that time, we were hiring a company out of Scott City, Kansas, that specialized in train wrecks. And the equipment picking them cars up and everything, other than them two steam derricks that shows on the film, is out of Scott City, owned by that company. And they were good.
Well, it looked like it got cleaned up pretty fast.
Yeah, well, it took about 4 days, I think. And the last thing that happened, it was welding a piece on one car they were going to pull on a track and set the weed fire out, so the city fire department had a chance to make a fire run and go out and put the fire out. But then the last of the film, that train that comes down there at the last of the film, that's the first train through the wreck area after they cleaned up, and it was the old mail train number 7. It was all mail headed for the west coast. Mid journey went through here about 60 miles an hour, and it was only around about 20. But it's just things that happened, but it could have been a lot worse if it had been 300 feet east.
Well, if it had been the passenger train, the El Capitan.
Oh, yeah, it could have been a
going
passenger
60 miles
train
around.
Or anything.
Yeah.
And, in fact, later on, probably about 5 years later, we did derail the chief over at Ophla, right in front of the depot. But thank goodness the cars went north, and they really didn't tip over none, but we had a lot of injured people.
Mm-hmm. What caused that one?
Broken rail.
Was this fairly common in your career, or...?
Well, not really, but of course there's all kinds of things, but that was probably the most common one. Once in a while you'd have one from brake rigging, breaking and falling under the wheels and kicking it off track. But most of the really big wrecks were caused by a broken rail. And of course, we had one guy that rode the track every day inspecting track, but that don't stop, eyeballing. If the brake ain't seeable, the steel can be broke on the inside and look good on the outside, and then the pressure and trains, they put tremendous pressure on that rail, and it's amazing that there wasn't more there, and I expect the way they run trains now without anybody on the rear end and all that stuff, I'm amazed that they don't have trains strung all over the countryside, all over the country, because of the money-hungry people that don't want to pay somebody to do a job. And while I'm talking, maybe this ought to be off the record.
I can't. You want it out? I can stop it.
Well, no.
Okay.
But I want to mention something about this new gymnasium. I'm a little upset about it, and a little worried about it. And I never talked to nobody, but I've often laid at home in bed thinking about it. And when I come to Kinsley, there was two Santa Fe water towers sitting there, and there's a big well underneath that. And I keep thinking about, I don't know what kind of well it was, whether it was a drilled well or a dug well. And I think about that.
You don't think the engineers looked into that?
I'm curious if they did run geological deal on a survey before they ever put it on there. Because if they didn't, there is a cavern down under there. Because them two water towers, when we sold them and they were tore down, they went to a little town up north for their city water and put back together. And I don't know how many thousands of gallons of water them held, but we had, when I first come here, we had two water spouts beside the track, and we could water two engines at the same time, and in 5 minutes put over 10,000 gallons of water in them. And there was a well house there between them. And as near as I can remember, the west side of that round building is over the top of that well. And then you see on TV these pictures in California where people's driveways cave in, the street cave in. And all I can think about is that building sitting there on the outside of an S-curve with a train derailing there, and the minimum weight on any of them cars that go by there is 100 tons. At 35 mile an hour, and you got a ball game in there, it's full of people. Them cars are going right through that building. They couldn't build it strong enough to stop it. The kinetic energy, kinetic energy is too much. You can't build
it. No, you
can't,
yeah.
And then add to that, if we get a wet season, and that cavern or that water, them water towers was, they didn't do something about that, fill it in or something, besides to cave in, there goes the west side of that building. Same scenario, people in there. I hope I'm not alive if it ever happens. But that was a damn.
It's awfully close to the tracks.
Yeah, well, at least a little accident there, it's going to get damaged. I'll guarantee you, because it's on the outside of an S-curve. And centrifugal force is going to send the cars that way. And why they didn't put it over there where the old New Grove Hotel was and just make a parking lot there, I don't understand.
I wanted to connect it to the school.
Yeah, but they could have still connected it. I know towns that's got school buildings across from each other, and four-lane highways run through the middle of them, and they got upstairs walkways. But and I've been afraid to talk to Jay, because I don't think Jay would know anything about it. And hopefully they did. But I don't think many people in this town realize them two big tanks were there.
Well, not at this day and age. We may have some pictures that show it, but I'm not sure. But
I know when I first come here, my job was to make sure, part of it was to go down there and make sure the tanks were full, because you never knew when an engine was going
out. No, we had wondered, because you know that one building down there was a little gas station.
Yeah.
And we're not sure the gas tanks, you know, that were ever taken out.
Yeah, they were.
They were. Okay,
yeah,
you know,
I've
that.
Seen them do
okay,
that.
Okay, well, that's good.
Yeah, it was a gas station when mm-hmm. I come here, too.
I mean, did they take them out recently, or did they take them out when they closed the station?
Oh, it was quite a while ago.
Okay.
The state
come out. Yeah, there is a law to do
that. The state come out with a law that you couldn't leave mm-hmm. gas tanks, and they took them out at the same time they took the old independent station tanks out over there.
Well, that's good to know, because we had worried about that.
Yeah.
Well, I'm trying to think. Do you have any other railroad stories you want to get on this tape, or anything else from your life that you want to get on the tape?
I think you probably know more about me now than yeah, my wife did. But no, I can't think of it.
I'm just curious. Maybe a good way to end it then is railroads declined. You know, they weren't being used, and now they seem to be coming back. What do you see for future of railroads?
Well, the reason they declined was a lot of their revenue came from U.S. Post Office. All our passenger trains had RPO cards on them, which were, and you could mail a letter to the next town and it would be there in 15 minutes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That plus the airlines. The government started subsidizing airlines and building their airports for them, everything, and they wasn't doing nothing for the railroads. And we lost passenger service. In fact, there at the last, we had quite a bit of passenger traffic. But when you stop and think that one of them passenger cars is like a mobile motel.
Mm-hmm.
They even had diners and beds and everything. The postal department was actually making up the difference between the fares where the people paid to ride it and the cost of employing the people. And just, I guess you'd say modernization got to them. Railroads, on the bad side, was reluctant to change. They had owned transportation for so many years, you know, and they just get mad. Nobody can take it away from us. Well, then you got UPS and everybody else got their airline service, and it changed. So-called modernization, which is not really modernization, because if we still had passenger trains, we could move more people and more freight in less time across the United States than they can with the airlines. I don't care how big airplanes they got. We get 20 car passenger trains, there isn't an airplane as a whole that many people, plus their belongings and everything else. And we're the only country in the world that don't depend on rail service for mass transit. But our forefathers didn't foresee that, and our new fathers ain't got brains enough to see it. So, I mean, it's just...
Well, a few years back when gas got so expensive, you know, people were thinking about starting the rails up again for, even for personal transportation, but for freight, for sure.
Yeah. But it's one thing adds to another, and people were in a hurry. Mm-hmm. And an airplane can get them there faster, but not safer. and the railroad. But, of course, Japan beat that. They got 200 and some mile an hour trains. You can go clear across Japan the time it takes us to drive from here to Dallas. But the railroads, of course, they couldn't foresee you spending that much money to build they had little idea of what was going on, and their stockholders didn't want to lose money on their stocks. But it's amazing to me that they have deteriorated so far, really.
Well, and the other thing that's sort of amazing is a lot of the land that the railroads owned, they no longer own anymore. That if you wanted to go back, you know, they
well, they still own their right of way. That the part that they haven't give away or
yeah.
sold.
Yeah, that's what I mean. A lot of it, they've turned them into bicycle trails and all sorts of things, you know.
Well, my house was built on the railroad land.
Mm-hmm.
But that, of course, that big well, you know that big well at Greensburg was built by the Santa Fe.
The big hand-dug one?
Yeah.
Because they were trying to get water for the train.
They when the government gave the grants for land for the railroads to come out here, they wanted to expand west, and they had the Rock Island and the Santa Fe going for that ground. So the government told them, and this is in the history of the book there at the big well. Government told them, okay, the first railroad to Greensburg, Kansas gets the land. So that's why out of Hutch, the old Rock Island main line and the Santa Fe main line is parallel all the way to Abbeville before the Santa Fe bends off. But the Santa Fe went there and dug that handwell to furnish water for the crews coming out there. They were so sure it was going to be there first. They got beat by one day. So they had to bend off there at Abbeville and come this way, which is a longer route. The reason they were fighting for it, that's the shortest route between Chicago and Los Angeles, down through Greensburg and Liberal and that way, because we go up north to Lahaina and drop south. But it's amazing, a lot of that stuff I looked up. Of course, I didn't
know a lot of history.
I didn't realize until I was down there and reading the history in Greensburg years ago, I would have never guessed the South they dug it, but they did. But according to their records, they did. I'd like to see the railroads come back. I really would. But I think it would help the country. And I know it would help each individual because you know, wouldn't cost you an arm and a leg to go to Chicago on a passenger train. I think the highest price when they took them off in the late 60s at the time was $32.50 one way. And you can't even get a boarding pass for an airline for that.
I'm not sure anymore. You can still get on Dodge now and go to Chicago. But
yeah,
I don't know what it costs.
Yeah, it's not near that, and it's not near what it costs to fly there. But it's more than that.
Because
of
time changes.
Yeah, Dodge City Amtrak still. But that's not... That train don't belong to any railroad. That belongs to the U.S. government. But the railroad that it runs over has to sign up to get the service. The lease money for the government pays lease on going over the railroad tracks. For that railroad to get the money, they have to agree to maintain the track.
Yeah.
And see, when they first took over, it was kind of funny to me. And Amtrak took over, and they kept the name Chief, Super Chief, and El Cap. And they wouldn't never wash their engines. They wouldn't wash it, clean the outside of the train or nothing. And finally, Santa Fe took the names away from them.
Oh.
They didn't want to pay up. And a through train, like them hot shot trains, well, even the common of Galesburg and Albuquerque, they were wash racks. And they were built right on the main line. As the train come to town, it went through them wash racks. And as soon as Amtrak took over, they shut them down and took them out, and it cost too much money. But then the federal government let the president run on vacation on Air Force One and take two helicopters with him besides all the servicemen. And them horse racks cost too much money. Come on.
Well, is there anything, any other stories or anything else you want to add to this tape? You think I've worn you out?
Well, I'll think of a lot of them when I get home. But. But I'm always open to questions. You can always call me and ask.
All right. Well, I appreciate you spending the time. Let's see here. Come on, move. There it is.